Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, June 24th, 2020. Continuing with Section A. In Defense of Black Lives Forum by Sam Waller. In Defense of Black Lives, a local activist group will conduct a community forum to address concerns and considerations about policing and criminal justice, as well as education in Odessa. Talk of the Town, Policing, Education, and Next Steps to Solutions is scheduled for 6 p.m. Thursday at Floyd Gwynn Park, 1015 North County Road West. The forum provides community members an opportunity to come together and discuss the next steps community should take. Information shared during the forum will help find solutions and guide steps in meetings with both the Odessa Police Department as well as ECISD administrative leadership, a release announcing the event issued by In Defense of Black Lives detailed. In Defense of Black Lives previously organized a protest march through downtown Odessa on June 3rd, following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. That event drew several hundred participants who marched from City Hall to the Odessa Police Department. Our organization decided when we did our march that we were going to take several action steps to not just raise awareness for issues, but also find solutions, said Gavin Norris, a local attorney and one of In Defense of Black Lives organizers. Before we go to the table and talk to our community leaders, we need to be able to hear from the community and be their voice at the table. Norris said In Defense of Black Lives hopes to address three areas during the forum. One is policing in our community, how that's addressed, what specific areas can be involved to be preventative, considering the things that we see going on in our country right now, he said. The second thing is education. We're going to address education issues and the disparity within the community. The school district is doing some things, but we also want to be able to bring in real life voices to the issues that the community has that go far beyond the statistics that have been provided. There are a lot of people in the community who have anecdotal experience that they can provide on several issues, and there's some commonalities there. Our third thing is not just to hear what the issues are, but hear from the community solutions that they have coupled with whatever solutions we have so that we can bring something to the table and find common ground in policing and education. While the forum was originally planned to be held in the Floyd Gwynn Park gym, Norris said it likely will be moved outdoors to allow more people to participate while still following social distancing guidelines. In the midst of the COVID pandemic, especially in this area where the numbers are rising on those who are testing positive, we are being very COVID conscious, Norris said. We aren't requiring everyone to wear masks, but we are strongly, strongly encouraging everyone who shows up to wear a mask and social distance. The event will be live streamed on Facebook Live and Twitter, allowing those unable to attend to participate remotely in the forum. Community members may also engage with In Defense of Black Lives through Eventbrite, www.eventbrite.com/e/town-policing-education-next-steps-2-solutions-registration-110109926554. Another way, Facebook event, www.facebook.com/events/2380879741621666/. facebook.com/indefenseorg. Twitter @indefenseorg or https://twitter.com/indefenseorg. Instagram www.instagram.com/indefenseorg/. And email indefenseofblacklives@gmail.com. Organizers will attempt to provide hand sanitizer and other supplies. To help offset the cost of such items, In Defense of Black Lives is accepting donations of both money and supplies. Financial contributions may be made online at https://secure.actblue.com/donate/IDBL. Those wishing to donate supplies such as hand sanitizer, masks, or disinfectant wipes are asked to email indefenseofblacklives@gmail.com. UTPB Provost makes semifinalist list for Louisiana Post by Ruth Campbell. University of Texas Permian Basin's Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs, Dan Heimerman, is a semifinalist for the President's job at the University of Louisiana at Monroe, the university system website detailed. Cami Geisman, Vice President for External Affairs for the University of Louisiana System, said the timeline was pretty aggressive and it was planned to be complete in May, but COVID-19 put a stop to that. We had to extend it a little bit. One of the main parts of our process is having the candidates come to campus and meet and interview with different groups, including faculty and staff, students. Since we didn't have any students on campus, we decided it was appropriate to extend the timeline. So where we are, there is a list of semifinalists and they will hopefully be on campus the week of August 17th, which is the first week of the fall semester for University of Louisiana Monroe, ULM, and they'll do on-campus interviews, and the committee will name 2 to 3 finalists to interview with the full University of Louisiana System Board of Supervisors. Then they'll choose a president, and that president will hopefully start in the fall, Geisman said. It is still in the process, and that's kind of where we are, she added. UTPB President Sandra Woodley said she is aware that Heimerman is a semifinalist for the ULM post. And I am not surprised that there is a high level of interest in him as a leader. Dan's knowledge and expertise concerning the academic enterprise and his accomplishments at UT Permian Basin are impressive. UTPB has greatly benefited from his leadership over the past 6 years. While we hope that Dan remains with us for a long time, it would not be at all surprising if his talent and record of accomplishment led to the next natural step in his career trajectory, a presidency or chancellorship. I can state categorically that any university would be most fortunate to have him as their leader, Woodley said in a statement. There were 18 candidates originally, she said. Along with Heimerman, other candidates are Catrice Albert, Executive Vice President of S2A Solutions, Dean of the College of Business and Social Sciences at the University of Louisiana at Monroe, Timothy Holcomb, Associate Professor, Fellow of Farmer School of Business, Andrews, Miami University, Janine Kahn, Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs, Louisiana of University of Louisiana System, Julia Letlow, Executive Assistant to the President for External Affairs and Community Outreach, University of Louisiana at Monroe, and Sherry McMahon, Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs, California State University, Fullerton. We had a lot of interest in the position, and we were very pleased. Our search process is one that has been refined over the years, and we're really, really comfortable with how the search process goes, and we usually get a really nice pool of candidates. It doesn't come easy. You have to do a good job spreading the word about the job, and then they come in. We were very pleased, Geisman said. The Monroe campus has more than 9,000 students and has an emphasis on health sciences. They have dental hygiene and a nursing school. The campus is scheduled to open the Edward Villa College of Osteopathic Medicine in August, and plans are to start a physical therapy program around 2021. It's a beautiful campus. It's right on the bayou, and they have, I think, they have more water skiing national championships than any other school in the nation, Geisman said. The University of Louisiana System has 9 universities throughout the state with about 92,000 students. Big Bend seminars scheduled. Residents of West Texas are invited to attend a free series of seminars on energy development in the Big Bend later this year. The seminar series got underway in January 2020, but 3 of the seminars were canceled, one due to weather and the others to the COVID-19 pandemic. The seminar series is being rebooted for the fall with new topics and speakers. The series is designed to engage a broad constituency of Big Bend community members to better inform them on recent energy projections, potential impacts on communities and conservation values, and to develop creative strategies to conserve the unique resources and communities of the region. There are 3 seminars scheduled in fall 2020, and assuming COVID-19 is on the wane by then, the seminars will be held from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Espino Conference Center at Sol Ross State University in Alpine. On September 16th, the topic is Development by Design, Where Development and Conservation Meet. Keynote speakers are Joe Kiesecker, the Nature Conservancy of Texas, and Melinda Taylor, University of Texas at Austin. On October 8th, the topic is Landowners, Energy Development, and Conflict, Finding Common Ground. Keynote speakers will be David Yates, Texas Wildlife Association, Chris West, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and Chase Curry, San Pedro Ranch. On October 22nd, the topic is Conservation Values and Strategies for the Last Frontier. Keynote speakers will be Lewis Harvison, Borderlands Research Institute, and Billy Tarrant, Borderlands Research Institute. The seminar series is sponsored in part by Respect Big Bend Coalition, Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation, Permian Basin Area Foundation, the Meadows Foundation, Stillwater Foundation, and the Borderlands Research Institute, BRI, at Sol Ross State University. OPD asking for public's help on hit and run. The Odessa Police Department is asking for the public's help in an auto pedestrian hit and run that occurred at about 10:27 p.m. June 20th in the 3300 block of South Dixie. Investigation revealed that the suspect's vehicle is a 2015 to 2019 Ford F-150, missing the passenger side mirror and radio antenna. Anyone with information in reference to this incident is encouraged to contact Hit and Run investigator M. Stewart at 432-335-5759 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS and reference case number 20-0010935, a news release detailed. The investigation continues. On June 20th, at approximately 10:27 p.m., Odessa Police and Odessa Fire Rescue responded to the 3300 block of South Dixie in reference to a hit-and-run involving a pedestrian. Investigation revealed that a Cleveland Laverne Harris, 30, was walking on the west side of the roadway in the 3300 block of South Dixie. Investigation revealed that a pickup was traveling in the 3300 block of South Dixie and struck Harris. The driver of the pickup failed to stop and render aid and fled the scene without meeting legal requirements. Harris was transported to a local hospital with life-threatening injuries, the release said. Free testing on the way. During Tuesday's County Commissioners meeting, city officials, including Assistant Fire Chief Joey White, said they plan to do extensive COVID-19 testing at 8 city parks and buildings this summer and fall. Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes also reported bringing back the National Guard for a second round of testing, July 1st and 2nd, at Kellis Turner Park, 2230 Sycamore Drive in West Odessa, and the South Ector County Volunteer Fire Department at 4454 West Apple. The Ector County Health Department detailed on their website Tuesday that there are 632 total people who have tested positive for COVID-19 in the county. The website shows that 396 positive cases are confirmed, 236 cases are probable, and 381 of those cases are active. The health department detailed that 7 Ector County residents have died from COVID-19 related complications, and 244 have recovered from the virus. A press release from the health department regarding nursing homes showed that Focused Care at Odessa has had 14 positive cases, including one death. One staff member at Deering's nursing home has tested positive, and 4 staff members at Sienna Nursing Home have tested positive. The release included a statement from the health department detailing that the confirmed and probable case count has been rising, and several have expressed concerns throughout the community. The rise in numbers seems to be alarming, and that is understandable, the update states, stressing the need to protect those most vulnerable to the virus by wearing masks and staying home if having symptoms. The health department asked everyone to protect loved ones who would be significantly impacted if they got the virus, including grandparents and the immunocompromised. Many of the confirmed cases are 21 to 30 years old who reported mild symptoms. The main focus is to keep our hospitalizations down and not overload the hospitals. Please take actions to protect others around the community and reduce the spread, the release stated. Medical Center Hospital reported 232 positive cases in a Tuesday press release. 15 of those people are in the hospital. 10 patients are on the designated floor, including one patient from Focused Care at Crane and 2 patients from Focused Care at Odessa. Obituaries for Wednesday, June 24th. Robert Eric Evanson. Robert Eric Evanson, 66, passed away Sunday, June 21st. He was born in Odessa, November 17th, 1953, to the late Robert and Ellen Mabry Evanson. In addition to his parents, Eric is preceded in death by his sister, Karen Gail Evanson, who passed away in December of 2019. He is survived by a niece, Kara Evanson, Dorothy, and husband Dan of Odessa, and several great nephews. Memorial services will be held Friday, June 26th at St. Andrew Cumberland Presbyterian Church at 2 p.m. with Dr. Jimmy Braswell officiating. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West Funeral Chapel, and condolences to the family may be sent online at acreswestfuneral.com. Charles H. Robbins. Charles H. Robbins of Odessa passed away June 20th at the age of 95. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Friday, June 26th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home Chapel with Reverend Clydell Chapman officiating. Charles was born October 3, 1924 in Lawrenceville, Illinois to Mary Louise and Charles Robbins. He is survived by his wife of 23 years, Patsy, a son, Robert, of Rockford, Illinois, daughters Carolyn of California and Linda of New York, 4 stepdaughters, 1 stepson, 12 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and 5 great-great-grandchildren. He was a casualty of COVID-19. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations to your favorite charity. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send family condolences, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Johnny Faye Hudson. Johnny Faye Hudson passed away June 18th. She was born in Bremen on February 9th, 1939, to the late E.C. Corona Sr. and Rosie Cofield Corona. She was preceded in death by her husband, Frank James Hudson, her parents, E.C. Corona Sr. and Rosie Cofield Corona, daughter, Rhonda Arnold, her brothers, A.D. Edwards, Ernest Cofield, Uncle Fatty, and A.Y. Corona, Uncle Rogers, and her sisters, Johnny Mae Godfrey, Dorothy Corona, Princelle Miller, and Pearline Davis. Surviving her are her sons, James Arnold and wife Rose, Tony Hudson, daughters Alice Arnold, Brenda Lee, Belinda Arnold, Detri Arnold, Dorothy Hudson, and Sandra Allen, all of Odessa. A brother, Charles Corona and wife Lydia of Slayton, 2 grandsons that she raised, Tavaeus Allen and Demory Wilkerson, 15 grandchildren and 21 grandchildren, as well as a host of nieces and nephews. Viewing will be held Wednesday, June 24th at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home from 4 to 8 p.m. A funeral service will be held Thursday, June 25th at Freedom Missionary Baptist Church at 1 p.m. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Death notices. Roberto Gonzalez. Roberto Gonzalez, 87, of Odessa, died Saturday, June 20th. A funeral service is scheduled for 10 a.m. Friday, June 26th at Odessa Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at the Odessa 2 section of Hector County Cemetery. Severo Greg Gonzalez IV. Severo Greg Gonzalez IV, 52, of Odessa, died Friday, June 18th. A celebration of life is scheduled for Saturday, 8 a.m. to 9 p.m., June 27th, at Acres West 24-Hour Chapel. Felipe de Jesus León. Felipe de Jesus León, 33, of Odessa, died Sunday, June 21st. Funeral service is scheduled for 10 a.m. Friday, June 26th at Martinez Funeral Home Chapel. The family has opted for a private cremation to follow.
Health and wellness. Sales tax needed to provide health care services. Russell Myers, Midland Health. Voting information. Early voting for the Midland County Hospital District sales tax election begins June 29. Election day is July 14. For details on voting locations and schedules, go to co.midland.tx.us. Midland County Hospital District provides more than $40 million per year in support of a wide variety of community health care services beyond the operation of Midland Memorial Hospital. These services are essential to the community's health and for many years have been fully funded by federal Medicaid supplemental payments. These payments are projected to decline by $23 million in fiscal year 2021, with annual cuts reaching $38.4 million by fiscal year 2024. To replace the lost federal funding, MCHD has called for an election on July 14 to levy a tax on the sale of taxable items within the district at a rate not to exceed 0.25%, 0.25% of the sales price of the taxable item sold anywhere in Midland County. Should voters approve the ballot item, sales tax collections could provide a projected $28 million per year for MCHD to use for community health care services funding. Over the past several weeks, articles in this space have described a variety of community health care services that are funded by Midland County Hospital District. The ability of MCHD to continue supporting these essential health care functions is in question because of the substantial federal funding cuts expected over the next 4 years. The following is a recap of the services most at risk. Physician recruiting and support. Recruiting physicians to Midland has always been a challenge and requires promises of compensation at the upper end of the market to attract any interest. Once recruited, these physicians expect that level of compensation to continue, even if their practices do not generate enough collections, especially because the requirement that they accept Medicare and Medicaid where applicable. If MCHD does not supplement their practice revenues, we probably cannot recruit and retain those doctors. Graduate medical education. Medical residents and the faculty who teach and supervise them are generally funded by the teaching hospitals in which they work. If MCHD does not provide financial support to Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, residents will not be trained in Midland to help produce our next generation of physicians. Midland Community Healthcare Services. This nonprofit system of community clinics receives federal funding to provide primary care to our uninsured and Medicaid populations. Without MCHD's financial support, the capacity to care for this underserved population will be reduced even further. Inpatient behavioral health. Patients in behavioral health crisis can be stabilized in our emergency department, but must then be transferred to specialized facilities such as Oceans or the Springboard Center for definitive treatment. If MCHD cannot pay for the care of those with inadequate insurance, they will not receive the intensive care they need to return to productive lives. Specialists on call. Every day, physicians in 20 different specialties are available to come to the emergency department if needed. If we can no longer compensate them for the personal and professional time commitment this requires, then fewer specialists will be willing to be on call, and our patients can no longer be assured of having the specialist they need, ready to care for them in an emergency. MCHD has proposed a 0.25% sales tax to replace lost federal funding and assure our ability to continue funding these vital community health care services. Russell Myers is President and CEO of Midland Health. Finding a trend. TTU professors develop COVID-19 prediction model. From staff reports. Professors in Texas Tech University's Department of Mechanical Engineering have developed a new epidemiological model for predicting COVID-19 spread and have made predictions for 6 representative U.S. states, California, Louisiana, New Jersey, New York, Texas, and Washington. Faisal Hussein, the President's Endowed Distinguished Chair in Engineering, Science, and Medicine, Zaina Khan, a Research Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering, and Frank Van Woosel, a postdoctoral researcher, recently submitted their paper, A Predictive Model for COVID-19 Spread Applied to 6 U.S. States, to Nature Medicine, according to a press release from TTU. Our goal was to combine our expertise in bioengineering and computer modeling to develop a comprehensive model for predicting COVID-19, including the most important and relevant parameters, and to compute and interpret the results in terms of relevant parameters, Hussein said in a statement. This model incorporates a number of parameters of significant relevance to pandemics, particularly COVID-19, and is capable of making predictions of such parameters and their interdependence, according to the release. We decided to create a new model of this coronavirus in order to predict a larger range of parameters that prior models don't, Khan said. One major feature is the asymptomatic spreaders, people who don't know they are sick, wander into society and spread the virus. Another feature is the lockdown that we all have experienced. We decide to start from that perspective and build a new model. This kind of model is described as a compartment model, where society is divided into conceptual compartments. The compartments used in the model are susceptible, undetected, infected, detected, recovered, social distancing, undetected recovery, death, and detected deaths. The susceptible population is the majority of the population of a region or country at the onset of the disease, Khan explained. There's a small number of what we call unknown infected, because they're not sick enough to realize and go for testing, be hospitalized, or stay home. There's a small number of those who start the spread of the infection. Then, as people's symptoms progress, or as a result of randomized testing, they become detected infected. These detected infected people either go on to recover, which puts them in a new compartment, or they die, and that's another compartment. Hussein said other aspects also play a pivotal role in who may or may not be more susceptible to contract coronavirus. Factors such as culture, food habits, political systems, skin color, and latitude are variables, he said. For example, with China's political system, if they are ordered to stay 6 feet away from one another tomorrow, everyone would comply. Latitude is a major factor because of how much sunshine a person is exposed to. The paper makes some predictions, including, in continued lockdown, COVID-19 infections will persist for at least 2 years. Infections, however, will rapidly rise by an order of magnitude if lockdown is lifted, peaking after 2 months, recurring yearly, similar to influenza. Repeated lockdowns and releases do not avoid an endemic infection, even following a White House release guideline of 14 days of declining cases, or even a stricter 28 days. Earlier lockdowns would have cut COVID-19 deaths in New York, but not in Texas. Infections could be curtailed by stringent measures such as strict lockdown compliance, face masks, social distancing, contact tracing, and isolation, etc. The reason why earlier lockdown would have saved tens of thousands of lives in the state of New York, but wouldn't have made much of a difference in Texas because of how well New York complied with lockdown measures, Khan said. The most telling aspect of their paper is the numbers. By October 1, there could potentially be 3 million COVID-19 cases and 235,000 total deaths in the U.S., according to their predictions.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the education section of the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020. Some students might get more classroom time. Texas is among states where some schools can have longer days and a longer academic year, by Jay Matthews from the Washington Post. Nearly everyone is wondering how to start what will be the most uncertain new school year of our lifetimes. I sense both fear and hope. It's going to be a mess, but that may inspire worthy innovations. Here is my suggestion. For decades, the average American neighborhood school has ignored what appears to be one of the best tools for raising achievement, increased learning time. Why not do something about that? Many celebrated teachers have shown the power of stealing a few hours from lunch or after school, but policymakers remain uninterested. We have been stuck for decades with just 6.5 hours of school a day, 5 days a week, 180 school days a year. It is a failure of imagination, says Chris Gabrielli, one of the nation's leading advocates for more time. People are so inured to the system we have had that they cannot imagine just changing the parameters. Gabrielli, chairman of the Massachusetts Board of Higher Education and a lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, has learned to live with this frustration. He said the lack of sufficient time is wired into our schools in two ways. We have known no other system our whole lives, and teacher contracts in strong union states require that any schedule changes be negotiated. There are, however, enclaves of extended time that could grow larger out of desperation in the chaos of the coming months. The nonprofit organization Empower Schools, where Gabrielli serves as CEO, and other activists have designed and launched 10 empowerment zones in Massachusetts, Texas, Colorado, and Indiana. In those places, the educators at about 50 schools with 25,000 students decide the schedule, permitting them to choose longer school days and sometimes longer school years. Texas also passed important legislation last year that will allow any district in the state to add 30 days to the school year and be reimbursed for half of the normal daily amount. One suggestion for ensuring enough physical space between students this fall would be to have two shifts with fewer students in each class. Teachers are more effective if class sizes can be cut below 18 students, research has found. That may also be a way to work more time into the day for each child. In Massachusetts, advocates successfully argued in some districts for 30 to 33% more time, an additional 300 hours a year. That came out to 1 hour and 40 minutes a day and two more class periods. We generally argued for one period of pure personalized support for students on the skills where they are needed more support, and one period of well-rounded education, such as arts and music, with some students who really need it having both periods devoted to academic support. The Massachusetts time expansion effort was able to get those extra 300 hours for just $1,300 per student, much less than 30% of all costs, despite teachers negotiating increased pay. More learning time added to the day costs no more lunch food, no more bus rides, no more superintendent and central office staff time. The most successful public charter school networks made their reputations with longer school days, leading to higher achievement rates, even for the children of low-income parents. School schedules in KIPP, the largest charter network with 242 schools, vary from region to region, but tend toward a school day lasting from 8:20 a.m. to 4 o'clock p.m., said KIPP Foundation spokeswoman Maria Alcon Herro. That is an hour longer than the national average. Just how schools could sort out their catastrophic problems this fall and still add more time is anyone's guess. My idea would be to add to each day an hour of quiet reading by students, enjoying books they pick themselves. That could be done while teachers sit at their desks preparing future lessons. Midland College Profiles by Travis Woodward. First generation graduate answers her calling. Ashley Gonzalez is the first member of her family to graduate from college. Even though none of her immediate family has reached that point, they encouraged her journey every step of the way. "Nursing is a calling," she said, "one that I am ready to answer." Gonzalez was born and raised in Midland and graduated from MC in 2015 with an Associate of Applied Science degree in nursing. Following graduation, she began working in the labor and delivery department at Midland Memorial Hospital, where she took care of moms going into labor, delivered babies, and assisted in the operating room with C-sections. She then worked for 2 years as a travel nurse, traveling between Uvalde, San Antonio, and Abilene to provide care to people in those communities. 2017 was a big year for Gonzalez. She got married and decided to pursue a master's degree in nursing. Building on the success and confidence that she gained during her time at Midland College, Gonzalez continued her education at the University of Texas at Arlington. Last month, she received a Master of Science degree in nursing, family nurse practitioner. "The education I received at Midland College enabled me to be where I am today. I always wanted to be a nurse. I am a people person and love taking care of people." Gonzalez attributes the MC staff and faculty with helping her find her way. She said her learning experience was enhanced by the nurturing campus environment and the high-caliber, state-of-the-art classroom facilities. "Midland College did an excellent job of guiding me and letting me know the quickest way to accomplish my goals." She said her instructors were experts in their fields and knew the content and material. Gonzalez said she was comfortable going to them with questions. "The program at MC made me a very well-rounded nurse," she said. "I've always looked up to healthcare professionals. It's pretty amazing to be a part of their team now." Deanne White, Associate Degree Nursing Department Chair and Associate Professor of Nursing, praised Gonzalez. "We are extremely proud of Ashley and of all our graduates," White said. "Each Midland College graduate sets a goal, works hard to be successful, succeeds, and is now entering a rewarding career as a professional nurse. As any future nurse knows, preliminary coursework lays the groundwork for the next pivotal moments, taking the American Associates of Nurse Practitioner exam. Although the test was delayed by the COVID-19 pandemic, passing the boards is now Gonzalez's focus. Once she does that, she's on her way. She is currently working in geriatric home care, but has not yet decided on what will be her ultimate career path. "I chose family practice because it is such a broad area and I can choose to specialize later. I would like to focus on women's health or geriatric home health." What advice would Gonzalez give to potential students? "Keep going. It can be hard. Sometimes you have self-doubt, but keep going and push through it. Ask for help if you need it. I am grateful for the educational opportunities that I received, and I am excited to return to Midland to help my community." Congress needs to increase financial aid. A guest view. Minority, low-income students are at risk of deferring or foregoing college. The coronavirus outbreak forced students at colleges across the U.S. to finish the spring semester at home. As Congress considers additional relief for higher education, lawmakers should focus on helping students at greatest risk of abandoning their studies altogether. According to surveys, enrollment in four-year colleges could drop by as much as 20% this fall. Attrition among poor and minority students is likely to be worse. Close to two-thirds of minority students say the crisis has changed their higher education plans, and 4 out of 10 graduating from high school likely won't enroll in college this year. Their hesitation is understandable. Some schools have outlined plans for resuming in-person instruction, but many college students can expect to receive much of their instruction online, an unappealing option for some, and a prohibitive one for those who lack reliable broadband access at home. In effect, the recession has made college even less affordable for low- and middle-income students, requiring them to borrow more to cover expenses such as books and food. For these students especially, choosing to defer or forego college will be damaging. More than 30 million Americans have some college but no degree. Only 15% of the lowest-income students get a bachelor's degree within 8 years of leaving high school. Among dropouts, fewer than 15% re-enroll within 5 years. Students who fail to complete a credential earn less, suffer higher unemployment, and are more likely to default on their student loans. The simplest way to help vulnerable students stay in school is to raise Pell Grants, the federal government's main form of need-based aid. More than 75% of Pell recipients are from families with incomes below $40,000. The maximum annual award of $6,345 for 2020-21 covers less than one-third of the total cost of attending a four-year public university. Doubling it would cover half the cost for the lowest income students. The additional public outlay, at least $30 billion a year, would be substantial, but hardly excessive in the context of the stimulus plans under discussion. Support for the neediest students should be more flexible, too. Jobless adults and students whose parents are unemployed and in financial difficulty should be eligible for help, as during the last recession. Easing lifetime limits on eligibility would encourage lower-income workers to return to school and complete their credentials. And four-year schools should work with community and technical colleges to make it easier to transfer credits between their institutions so students can get their degrees faster. Student aid is just one fragment of a much larger problem. American higher education faces a host of other financial challenges, and they'll demand a sustained and comprehensive government response. But first things first. Right now, Congress needs to help the students most at risk. Education. MISD to work toward no failing campuses by September 2025. By Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HurstNP.com. An early draft of Midland ISD's next governance plan shows a district hopes to see the elimination of failing campuses by September 2025. Constraint Progress Measure 2.1 states the number of F campuses will decrease from 9 to 0. By September 2025. The Texas Education Agency reported last fall that 9 elementary schools received scores below 60. Bunch, DeZavala, Henderson, Jones, Pease, Technology and Communications, Sam Houston Collegiate Preparatory, Scarborough Travis, and Washington STEM Academy. By contrast, only 4 campuses received either a B or an A. Grades won't be reported this year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Failing schools have been an issue for Midland ISD. The 2005-06 school year was the last time at least one non-alternative MISD campus wasn't giving one of the TEA's lowest ratings. Academically unacceptable. Improvement required or given an F grade. In both 2014 and 2015, the TEA reported the district had 11 failing campuses. As recently as 2018, that number had dropped to 4. But the TEA delivered a setback for the district with the report that its total more than doubled in 2019. The 9 failing MISD campuses are more than triple the number of failing schools in Harlingen, Brownsville, McAllen, Mission, and El Paso combined. The annual targets have the number failing schools dropping to 4 by 2021 and then eliminating 1 a year until 2025. Midland ISD leaders said during a discussion last week about other goals, it was important that the goals be attainable. The specific constraint in Midland ISD's Lone Star Governance Report is the superintendent will not allow adult convenience or preference to take priority over the academic progress of students. Constraints are specific operational actions that are not used or allowed and are aligned with the vision and grounded in community values, according to the TEA. Constraint progress measures are specific, graph-plottable indicators used to determine if the constraint is likely to be honored or not. This past week, Midland ISD leaders went over its governance plan as it heads into the 2021 school year and beyond. MISD staff told board members that updating its plan requires new goal progress measures and constraint progress measures, among other action. Setting goals and then abiding by specific action to reach those goals are part of the governance program. The TEA defines goal monitoring as the process of monitoring adherence to progress toward the board's adopted student outcome goals. The TEA also states that no fewer than 50% of the minutes spent in board-authorized public meetings should be invested in goal monitoring or goal setting.
To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Dear Dr. Roach, I am writing because my mother is convinced that eggs are unhealthy. I've read that eggs are the most complete food on earth except for bee pollen. What risk is there in eating an egg or two per day? JY. Answer. There is no such thing as a complete food. The science is clear that a diverse diet is best, since no single food contains all the nutrients for ideal health. Both eggs and bee pollen have a wide variety of amino acids, fats, and vitamins, but are still incomplete. The health benefits and harms of eggs continue to be debated. Eggs contain saturated fat and cholesterol, and although most data suggest that excess amounts of these increase heart disease risk, the net health effect of eggs remains uncertain, with some studies showing modest harm from more than 7 eggs per week, while others show none, but no net benefit either. Given the uncertainty, I recommend no more than 7 eggs per week for the lowest heart disease risk, but a few more is unlikely to have a major harmful effect.
Dear Abby, women's attraction to man complicates their friendship. Dear Abby, my friend Lauren and her husband separated for a few months last summer. During the separation, she had a short fling with my friend, Zach, whom she met at my house. Lauren decided to continue her marriage and, obviously, chose to stop seeing Zach. A few months ago, Zach came to a party I threw. Lauren wasn't able to make it. Everyone had a few margaritas, and as the night ended, I found myself having sex with Zach for the first time since our friendship began 10 or so years ago. It was so great, and we decided to do it again. I wasn't sure I should tell Lauren, even though she's a married woman, because I was afraid it might upset her. A week ago, Zach confessed that he may be in love with me, and I feel the same way toward him. I decided to go ahead and tell Lauren, since my relationship with Zach is getting serious. She reacted terribly. She was furious and accused me of betraying her and trying to one-up her. She said I should have known how she felt about him and that I'm a terrible friend for having sex with him, let alone falling in love. Abby, are her feelings justified? Am I in the wrong? Or are we all still adults? Accidentally in love. Dear accidentally in love, Lauren's feelings justified? Heck no. If you and Lauren are still speaking, remind her that when she went back to her husband, she relinquished all claims on the man she slept with in the interim. He's entitled to a life, and so are you. If I were you, I'd distance myself from this woman. She shouldn't begrudge you for enjoying someone she can't enjoy herself. Shame on her. Dear Abby, I'm a student at an art school, and I'm struggling with anxiety and depression. I have been on lockdown in my hometown due to the COVID-19 pandemic, isolated from my friends and unable to socialize with others. Sometimes when I watch the news, I become very anxious, and I wonder if there's a light at the end of these dark times. What should I do? Anxiety Ridden in Atlanta. Dear Anxiety Ridden, welcome to the club. If you think you have been alone and experiencing these emotions, you couldn't be more wrong. Many people feel just the way you do, anxious, isolated, and depressed. You can manage negative emotions by getting out of the house and exercising, alone or with friends or neighbors, while staying a social distance apart, and keeping in touch with friends and classmates using your computer and cell phone. There's no reason you couldn't collaborate with some of them on an art project and create something spectacular using those devices. Remind yourself that this quarantine is temporary. It isn't going to last forever. Unless you have an underlying health condition or someone in your household does, you can mingle with others wearing a face covering and keeping your distance. From what I've been observing, some relationships have been strengthened as people reach out to comfort and help each other. A surefire way to overcome the blues is to start thinking about what you can do for someone else, even if it's just a phone call to say, "I'm thinking about you. How are you doing?" Jacqueline Bigger Stars by Madeline Aslan. Note, Bigger Stars is based on the degree of your sun at birth. The sign name is simply a label astrologers put on a set of degrees for convenience. For best results, readers should refer to the dates following each sign. A baby born today has a sun in Cancer and a moon in Leo. Happy birthday for Wednesday, June 24, 2020. Both imaginative and skillful, you are completely taken up with your vocation. Because you work best in your often secret home base, this quarantine time proves very successful. Resourceful, you have money saved. If single, you want to be left alone to do what you love most, so you stay single. If attached, your partner must observe your strict privacy rule, and in so doing, you actually grow closer together. Leo adores you. The stars show the kind of day you'll have. 5 dynamic, 4 positive, 3 average, 2 so-so, 1 difficult. Aries, March 21 through April 19. 5 stars. Today highlights your love life and partnership matters. Charming Venus graces your sign, attracting others to you. Make yourself over and enjoy the result when your sex appeal quotient soars, perhaps even more than you want. Tonight, heed advice from friends. Taurus, April 20 through May 20. 2 stars. Many of you will have the opportunity to change your residence. Some of you will use this for redecorating or for having company visit from out of town. Watch out for intense power struggles or confrontations with partners. Tonight, do not go looking for trouble. Gemini, May 21 through June 20. 3 stars. Exchange ideas. Be a good listener. With your tendency to daydream today, you could miss out on or misinterpret important details. A flurry of emails and messages swamp your desk and demand instant replies. Tonight, a problem linked to childcare suddenly dissolves. Cancer, June 21 through July 22. 3 stars. Watch out for financial squabbles today, although any that arise should be resolved in the next few days as opportunities for extra income surface. Those involved in health occupations or in spiritual work benefit the most. Tonight, find a quiet space for meditation. Leo, July 23 through August 22. 5 stars. You are at your most charming and attractive today. However, you are also at your most self-indulgent. Movie star mannerisms are what this planetary vibration imparts, and you can certainly provoke a lot of attention now. Tonight, you will want to have it all. Virgo, August 23 through September 22. 4 stars. Paying attention to what is happening with you on a psychological level will be important today. Some of you will spend this time being creative or enjoying solitary hobbies such as music and art. Others will help a loved one. Tonight, inner healing occurs. Libra, September 23 through October 22. 5 stars. Being a member of a group is invaluable now. Friends suggest new goals and projects after a recent disappointment. Those who genuinely like you offer practical support. You will experience more tranquility than you have experienced in many months. Tonight, give gratitude. Scorpio, October 23 through November 21. 4 stars. Today favors the forming of pleasant business contacts, which leads to future jobs or increased income. You impress superiors. Service work involving hospitals, evening hours, research, or computer technologies is especially highlighted. Tonight, catch up with an elderly relative or loved one. Sagittarius, November 22 through December 21. 4 stars. Long distance matters take precedence today. You are likely to hear good news. But if planning summer travel, remember that plans will have to change unexpectedly, so be flexible. Those of you wanting to take exams should fare better. Tonight, things feel mildly chaotic. Capricorn, December 22 through January 19, 4 stars. Although payments due may be late, a confidential conversation with a family member helps you over the rough spots and managing your financial obligations. Do remember this is a year to be more conservative when it comes to money. Tonight, a sigh of relief. Aquarius, January 20 through February 18, 3 stars. Romantically speaking, your personality should be at its most alluring. However, Situations might become overly intense, leading to power struggles in love. Jealousy might overwhelm you if you are not grabbing all the attention. Tonight, dinner with ones you love the most. Pisces, February 19 through March 20, 3 stars. Social obligations and friends drain your resources today. Try not to let minor hassles in the workspace upset your stomach or equilibrium. Even if you are slightly frazzled, a raise in pay or a delightful new coworker could brighten up the picture considerably. Tonight, relax. Born today, writer Ambrose Bierce, 1842, boxer Jack Dempsey, 1895, philosopher Julia Kristeva, 1941.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.